On the Record
on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up. The new equation.
Welcome back. Gavin Riley with you on the record this Sunday lunchtime. 53106 is the number for your texts. Now, in recent weeks, there's been an opera on stage at the Abbey Theatre, which tells what by any account would be a fairly unlikely story. It's the story of an asylum in Monaghan, which was taken over by its staff and then proclaimed a Soviet. Now, the hospital itself still exists in Monaghan today, but the event and the declaration of it as being some kind of quasi-independent republic has been mostly forgotten until the story has been brought back to the stage. But it was international news in its day, and Donald Fallon has decided to shake off and brush off the dust of his old comrades to tell us a story about his fellow Reds. Donald, good to talk to you as ever. You're not with us today because you're lying low because you're in close contact. Hopefully we'll see you back before too long. It should be worth saying, actually, before we get into this particular production, the Abbey has returned with an awful lot that's new in recent times.
Yeah, and please, no jokes about the loony left, you know, talking about a lunatic asylum with a red flag. These are really exciting times in the Abbey Theatre for all kinds of reasons. I mean, there's a lot of new faces on and off the stage. Really, really happy for Mark O'Brien, the new executive director there, who was brought in from the thriving Axis Theatre in Ballymun, and, you know, has put kind of new life into the place. But I think the reopening of the theatres in recent times, like the return of live music, it brought a kind of degree of normality into our lives. Time will tell, sadly, how much of that remains. But for me, a return of bums onto seats in the National Theatre, it definitely lifted spirits. And when I was looking over what was coming up in the Abbey, I was really, really surprised to see this Elsewhere, which told the story of the so-called Monaghan Soviet, predating the more famous takeover of Limerick City. Mm. What happened in Monaghan in kind of late January 1919 was the first such significant event in Ireland, one of the first so-called Soviets outside Russia. And as we'll hear today, this was massive news internationally, with kind of plenty of exaggerated headlines on the other side of the Atlantic.
Yeah, and you can understand why it was of such interest to so many people around the world, because even for those who don't find Ireland so exotic, the words Monaghan Soviet do sound a little bit odd when you put them side by side. And yet it was a sequence of words that were on everyone's lips at the time that it all actually happened.
Yeah, look, against the backdrop of world events, new words kind of enter popular usage, or words that we don't use all the time become very popular. So depressingly, the word of 2020, according to Merriam-Webster, was pandemic. And dictionary.com also gave the word pandemic the 2020 word of the year. I don't know if we call it an award, but acknowledgement. But in the world of kind of late 19... Here's the award to you, COVID. But in the world of kind of late 1917, 1918, 1919... one of the words that really entered kind of mainstream consciousness, and which was kind of bandied about on all sides by all kinds of people for different reasons, was Soviet. And as a noun, I suppose Soviet means an elected local district or national council in the Soviet Union. But some in the press kind of used it as a word of fear, you know, that we might see Soviets popping up across Europe among disgruntled workers, and others kind of used the word positively. But it was a word that kind of came out of nowhere. No one had ever heard that word in 1917, but by 1918 and 1919, it was just bandied about in the newspapers all the time.
Yeah, I suppose one thing that's probably worth just pointing out for listeners who maybe don't understand the nuance, when people declare themselves as Soviets, they're not declaring themselves as being some kind of outpost or exclave of what we now know to be Russia. It's more a case of an ideology about where the worker is sovereign and that sort of a thing. Now, asylums were tough environments to work in, and maybe it sort of reflects a lot about Irish attitudes at the time, that even though they were very tough environments, Ireland had loads of them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, working in them was incredibly difficult. But before talking about the conditions of workers in them, the point that has to be made is that there was a disproportionately enormous number of Irish people in asylums. And they seem to have kind of become a place that not only people who had real mental health difficulties, but people that were on the margins of society could kind of very easily end up in them. And Brendan Kelly from Trinity College, a professor, does a lot of work on the history of asylums. He writes that, you know, in the context of Ireland in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, Ireland's appetite for institutional solutions to social problems, sounds familiar, yeah, was by no means unique. But while mental health hospitals expanded rapidly in many parts of the world, Ireland put a greater proportion of its population in psychiatric hospitals than any other country, which is just incredible to think about. And I mean, if you worked in an asylum, that was incredibly difficult. Like all workers, they were kind of feeling the pinch around that time of wartime inflation. Everything was more expensive. Your money wasn't going as far. And there was also an incredibly stressful working environment to be in.
Now, before the so-called Soviet was declared, I suppose it's probably safe to assume that this, you know, it's not something that happens overnight. People just don't wake up on a sort of a gloomy Sunday morning and just go, you know what, let's just declare this a Soviet today. Like, you presume that there has to be some trouble brewing there for a while first.
And it took a long, long time, but eventually two historians got down to the business of telling this story, you know, chronologically as it happened and explaining how it happened, Kira Mulholland and Anton McCabe. And they write about this as something that was building up for months. You know, 96 attendants at the asylum went on strike in March 1918. So that's just under a year before the so-called Soviet. And they won a war bonus of 4 shillings and union recognition, which were big achievements. But things kind of remained tense. There were more demands. And going into 1919, it kind of seemed like this thing was going to a head, like there could be a significant strike. And it was explained to the union organizer by the owners of the asylum that they work for 12 hours a day for 7 days, but they get every 13th day off and every fourth Sunday from 10 o'clock. So,
wow, how exactly, luxurious.
Not exactly. Yeah, exactly. 12 hour a day for 7 days and every 13th day off. It doesn't sound great. But the union organizer for the asylum workers was a guy called Padder O'Donnell, incredible life, later a distinguished novelist, magazine editor, literary critic, more besides. He came from Dunglow in the Rosses of Donegal. And at this point, he's kind of an up-and-coming figure. He's a young, rookie trade union official, a former school teacher, but he has incredible charisma. And when he arrives at the asylum, the workers put so much faith in him that they decide on the 24th of January 1919 that they're going to seize the building. So this had never happened before. And even in our own living memory, in recent years, I can think of so many examples of this, from Debenhams to Waterford Crystal. It's now quite a common tactic that when there's a dispute and workers are worried, they grab the site. But this kind of thing had never happened in Ireland before.
And I suppose it's worth bearing in mind too that this sort of thing had happened when land and property was not as infinitely valuable as it is now. So you can understand now, if workers have an issue, that basically you seize or you commandeer the thing which is most valuable, which is the site that it's actually on. Maybe not so much back in 1919. Some of the demands of the workers when they're declaring the Soviet, it might surprise us now, and maybe this is coloured by the fact that they worked 12 days in a row anyway, for 12 days at a stretch. Their reduced working week that they were demanding was still 56 hours.
Yeah, which is extraordinary, isn't it? And I mean, it seems that the place actually functioned quite well. Even the management of the asylum had to admit that to some extent the place was functioning maybe better than it did normally. And Mulholland and McCabe, they write about how one guy who was, quote, spreading defeatism was locked in a padded cell. So that was unfortunate for the worker. But there's 125 policemen kind of mobilized outside this asylum with a red flag flying over it. They'd never seen anything like this before either. They weren't entirely sure what to do. And the reports that end up in the American papers are brilliant. I mean, one US paper tells their readers, madmen armed with iron bars have joined striking attendants at the Monaghan Lunatic Asylum and are helping them to beat off the attacks of policemen. But in truth, there's no such violence. And actually, what the historians have looked at this in detail have found is there's evidence like they were playing football against the police, trying to take the police would just gather around the asylum, look at the red flag in the breeze. They'd play a game of football with the lads. And it just kind of, no one was really entirely sure how this thing was going to play out. But in the States, the journalists managed to make it perhaps a lot more exciting.
What does the place look like when it's declared a Soviet? Does it have any kind of outward external indications that anything is sort of different about it?
Padder O'Donnell orders the kind of barricading of the windows and the doors, and then the red flag in the breeze is the big thing. Okay. But there's also some accounts that the workers themselves, some of the international press claim that the workers change into what's called the inmate's uniform. So they kind of look like they could be the patients in case the place is actually stormed.
So like mismatched pajamas and the likes. Well, you know, each to their own. To the surprise of many, this bold experiment in like declaring the things to be the property of the worker and demanding for better rights, it all seems to work out pretty okay.
They seized the asylum on the 24th of January, and by the 4th of February, they returned to work. They'd won their demands, and they even hosted a victory dance, which at the time is a big thing in kind of Irish society, you know, the idea of gathering the village for a dance. And the kind of manner in which it ended is interesting. There's the intervention of local clergy. I have to imagine that, you know, the clergy were probably less enthused by a red flag flying over the local asylum than most people. But the victories are real. I mean, they win a reduced work week, 56. I imagine celebrating a 56-hour work week. A pay rise across gender lines, which is really interesting. You know, the same pay increase for men and women. And a big one, the right of married people to return home after their shifts ended. I mean, there had been a time when it was common for workers to stay in their workplace and to kind of live there in abodes, they won the right to go home when the working day was over. So these were quite significant victories.
It is genuinely remarkable that there was a time when you could be married and have a family of your own, but the nature of your work just kind of implied that you were expected to just hang around when your shift had ended. It's just remarkable how things have changed in a century. They may also have been the catalyst maybe for a couple of other famous examples of similar things that happened elsewhere shortly afterwards.
Yeah, like Monaghan is kind of totally forgotten, but people have vaguely heard something about what happened in Limerick, the Limerick Soviet, which came a little bit later. We talked about that in the slot before. That's a big event. You know, Limerick is a kind of significant enough city. There was a major global event on at the time in the towns, and a lot of the media were there. But in Limerick, there's the seizure of the town hall, and it's kind of like Monaghan. The red flag goes up over it. But during that Soviet, there was a reporter from the Chicago Tribune, and I just think the line is great because it reminds us that, you know, while these people in Monaghan and Limerick were influenced by what was happening elsewhere, they were still very Irish. The Chicago Tribune said, "The bells of the nearby St. Munchin's Church tolled the Angelus, and the red-badged guards rose and blessed themselves." So, there was still a great touch of Irish Catholicism in with the in with the Soviet influence. But over the course of the War of Independence, I mean, it's not that there's dozens, there's hundreds of smaller examples of this happening. Creameries, clothing manufacturing, bakeries. One occasion in Limerick, they painted the slogan, "We make bread, not profits," on the side of a bakery that's taken over. And most of these things are really small little curiosities that are kind of remembered locally, if at all, now. But I think there's something about Monaghan. You can see why this would appeal to a playwright, why someone would try and bring this to the big stage. The idea of workers willingly locking themselves inside of an asylum, it's perfect for the stage, isn't it?
Yeah, which then sort of brings us to the more contemporary question, which is, I suppose, opera and history sometimes making strange bedfellows, but how has elsewhere been received on stage?
Michael Gallen, who put this one together, it's been on in a few places, and the Dublin run was just a few days, sadly, but I think we'll see it on stage again. And what I really like about it was it shows how this decade of centenaries, it doesn't only belong to historians. You know, the arts can also take these kind of events and do interesting things with them. And listeners might be surprised to hear that the hospital is still there today, St. Davenant's Hospital in Monaghan. It's still there. Padder O'Donnell, if anyone's wondering, lived into his 90s, which was a great long life. He published a whole host of memoirs, one of which had an introduction by none other than Uachtaráin na hÉireann, Michael Higgins. But you could talk about all kinds of aspects of this man's life. I mean, from being there in the forecourts in the Civil War to being in the People's Olympics in Barcelona in 1936. It was just an incredible, very strange life, but I doubt Padder ever forgot his days in the workers-occupied Monaghan Asylum.
No, I certainly can't imagine he did. That opera is called Elsewhere. It's by Michael Gallen. It was on stage in the Abbey. Do keep an eye about it because you might be seeing it again before too long, if, of course, we're all allowed to keep going to events like that. Fingers crossed we will be. Donal Fallon, as ever, thank you very much. Donal Fallon, historian, author of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia and presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you can find anywhere you get your audio online.